For the next two Sundays, I would like to talk about the topic of communication. And I did this sermon back in Grand Rapids this summer, and then I also did it for a Bible study in Cincinnati. They were one-parters back then, and I kind of had to rush through it and glaze over some things. And so I'm turning into a two-parter this time, and I have added in a section of interesting things that I've gleaned over the years that have to do with the topic of communication that I've never really discussed, but I don't think, and maybe some of them I've talked about a little bit, but I've never really had a place to put them into a sermon, and they wouldn't be enough information for a sermon in themselves. And so I've just kind of tucked those away in the back of my mind, and I made some notes in my Bible, and then I thought that this would be a really good place to insert them. So I'm going to talk about that part today as well, and then finish up the series next week. And next week will be the most important part of it, in my opinion anyway. But, you know, there should be some good things in this part too, laying some foundational groundwork. So I've made this sermon for myself as much as for others. I myself would like to be a better communicator and a better conversationalist. I think we all probably would, I assume. I don't think anybody would say, you know, I wish I wasn't such a good conversationalist and I wish I could diminish in my abilities. I think everybody would probably want to get better if possible. And I certainly have a lot to learn. Just because I'm the one preaching the sermon on this doesn't mean that I have arrived or any such thing. I think it's a very tricky and difficult skill to master, being a good conversationalist. And I say that because I've probably only ever met a very limited number of what I would consider truly good conversationalists. As a matter of fact, I can think of one person right now that jumps out in my mind. I won't tell you who he is, but who is probably, actually I will tell you, Jason Corum from Minneapolis, no longer in the church, sadly. In my opinion, he was an excellent conversationalist. And I don't think I've ever met somebody quite as adept at it as he. But anyway, so that's why I say that, you know, most of us are average at best, but I haven't met very many people that I think are truly good conversationalists. And that tells me that it is a skill that must be practiced and honed, or else just a skill that is just God-given to somebody that's just totally natural to them. And even then, they still probably have to hone it to really get good at it. So that's the purpose of this study, is to look into some of these things and see if we can't improve on our communication abilities. I'm currently rereading Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, which is a famous book, been around for almost 100 years now. And there's a lot of good things in that book pertaining to this topic too, but I'm not really going to be talking about much of it because that was years ago that I read it, and none of that stuff's really in this outline unless I just remembered some of the things that I learned there. So anyway, without any further ado, let's start by defining some terms. Communication is the action of communicating or imparting. Now, communication primarily defined doesn't necessarily have to refer to verbal communication. It is communicating, and to communicate is to give to another as a partaker, to give a share of, to impart, to confer, transmit. So it's communicating or imparting, giving something to another person, in other words. And that can be physical things. The scripture talks about to do good and to communicate, forget not. And he's talking about giving, in that case, to support the ministry. So anyway, communication by definition primarily is giving something to somebody else. But we normally think about it as giving ideas and information to somebody else through verbal means or written means, possibly. And that's what the second definition goes on to say. The imparting, conveying, or exchange of ideas, knowledge, information, etc., whether by speech, writing, or signs. And then, fourthly, it is interchange of speech, conversation, conference. So the fourth definition would spill over into what would be called conversation, whereas communicating can be a one-way street, right? You can communicate information to somebody without them ever, you know, responding back to you. Conversation is the two-way street, and this is communication can also refer to that when you get down to number four. Communicate, I already read the primary definition of communicate. Number two, specifically, it is to impart information, knowledge, or the like, to impart or convey the knowledge of, inform a person of, tell. And then it cites Galatians 2:2 for this second definition of communicate. And we'll look at Galatians 2:2 here in a little bit. To impart, remember communication is imparting. To impart is to give a part or share of, to make another a partaker of, to bestow, give, communicate. And if you think about it, when you communicate verbally, you are taking something in your mind. Now, in this case, it's an immaterial thing, but you're taking a thing that you possess and you are transferring it to somebody else through verbal means. It's really a fascinating thing if you think about it. It's simple and complex at the same time. It's extremely simple. You think about, oh, I just have an idea and I talk and the other person knows what I'm thinking. But if you think about what actually happens, like you've got these neurons in your brain and you got these, you know, these thoughts that are stored in there somehow, and then your brain is sending signals to your tongue and your throat and your lungs, and then you're pronouncing these words, these symbols, and the other person then decodes these symbols to know the ideas and things that are coming out of your mind into their mind through their earways and the electrical signals that go to the brain. It's absolutely fascinating if you think about what actually happens in a conversation. So like I said, in one hand, extremely simple. On the other hand, not one of us could even possibly understand how it works. Really, if you really try to dig down and figure out exactly what's happening, none of us could. You'd have to be a genius. You probably have to be God yourself to really fully understand what's happening. And then conversation is primarily, this is not how I'm using it today, but the scripture does use it in this way, in some cases at least. It is the action of living or having one's being in a place or among persons. Our conversation is in heaven, the scripture says, right? But when I use conversation today, I am referring to sense number 7, interchange of thoughts and words, familiar discourse or talk. Now, we are designed by God to communicate with others. This is one of the fundamental things that makes human beings human, is our ability to communicate. Now, animals can communicate also, but not like we can communicate, right? And I think animals, through sounds and noises, and maybe even, I don't know if they have body language too, probably, they can communicate certain things to other animals, maybe fear or hunger or something, you know, like trying to intimidate them or scare them or things like that. But they can't communicate ideas and information, right, like we can. So we are distinct among the creation in this ability to communicate. And we're communicative beings, creatures, because we are created in the image of God, who is a communicative being. Let's just look at a familiar verse here in Genesis 1 and verse 27. And animals obviously can communicate with humans in a limited sense too. You've probably all either experienced it if you have animals, or seen videos of like the dog tearing up the kitchen and then the owner coming in and the dog's head's hanging low and he said, "Why did you do that?" And the dog's all ashamed and everything. Like he just knows, like he sees the owner come in, he sees a look on his face, he hears the tone of his voice and he knows something's wrong, right? And then he looks at the mess, he's like, "Oh yeah, that's what he's upset about." So they can communicate to an extent with us, but not like we can communicate with each other. Genesis 1 and verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. So being created in God's image, and God being a communicative being, therefore we are likewise communicative beings. In James 3 and verse 9 it says that we are made after the similitude of God. So we are similar to God in some ways, in many ways. James 3 and verse 9, therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. We looked at that verse last Sunday on a totally different topic, but this Sunday I'm just looking at it for that phrase there, which are made after the similitude of God. So we bear this part of God's image, being able to communicate. And God has communed with men personally throughout history. I'll just give you a couple of specific examples, and then I'll give you one obvious one that everybody should know. In Genesis 18:33, for instance, God was said to commune with Abraham. Genesis 18:33. And when you think about this, too, this is mind-blowing, that the God of heaven, the creator of all, and when you consider how big the universe is and how small this earth is, it's like a speck of dust in the scope of things. It's so infinitesimally small. And to think that on this infinitesimally small little ball of dirt, then there are, compared to that ball of dirt, there are infinitesimally small little people, and that the God that created it all communicates with those little people and even cares enough to communicate with them. That's really fascinating if you think about it. It'd be like me getting out an electron microscope and looking at quarks and just picking out one of the quarks and just deciding to make it my friend or something. Right? It's just like, I mean, that would be the scale, sort of, right? You know, some little molecule or something. Like, who cares about a little molecule? There's billions of them, right? Well, it's kind of like that with us. Why would God even care? There's this whole universe that he created and everything, and yet he cares enough to commune personally with men. Genesis 18, verse 33. And the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place. Now, we'll look at this passage yet today of what this communing entailed. This is an interesting passage as well for many reasons, one of which we'll look at today is that it gives us a bit of instruction on how to negotiate. And we'll look at that. And this was considered communing, where Abraham was negotiating with God. And then it also says in Exodus 25:22 that God would commune with the priests from the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant, I believe it was, in Exodus 25:22. Exodus 25:22. And there will I meet with thee, this is the Lord speaking, to Aaron and the priests. And there will I meet with thee, and will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubims, which are upon the ark of the testimony, of all things which I will give thee in commandment unto the children of Israel. So God would have personal communication with them from above the mercy seat. The mercy seat was the lid of the ark, and there were the cherubims, the angels that were above there looking into the ark, and that is where God dwelled. Between the cherubims, that's where he had personal communion and conversation with the priests, which would then relay that information to the people. And then God spoke through prophets throughout much of history, from the beginning of time up until the first century. God spoke by prophets personally to men, and then culminating that was him speaking to us through his Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, and his apostles that the Lord Jesus inspired to finish giving the message to men that he had. And we read about that in Hebrews 1:1-2. Hebrews 1:1-2. God, who at sundry times and in divers manners, so various times, different ways, spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds. So he spoke in different ways, different times, through the prophets and through angels. He said it was the Old Testament was given through the mediation of angels. But then in these last days, he hath spoken, which is a completed action there. He hath spoken unto us by his Son. So the revelation ended when the Son of God came and gave the words that the Father gave him to give to us. When he relayed those words to us and sent his Spirit to his apostles to finish that message, by the end of the first century, God hath spoken unto us by his Son. And he doesn't communicate with us directly, verbally, anymore, face to face, or with image, dreams, or visions, or audibly, or anything like that. He now communicates unto us through the Scripture alone, and that is the third point that I said I was going to make, which should be obvious, is that this whole book, this Bible, is God's communication to us. It's His letter to us. So God obviously is a communicative being, because unlike many of the other religions out there that do not teach that God communicates to us through the Scripture, through a book which He has inspired men to write down, Christianity, and there are other religions that believe similarly, but a lot of religions don't, Christianity teaches that this book is God's revelation to man. It's His communication to us. Now, the Bible extols face-to-face communication, and so should we. Let me just give you a couple of verses. One's in 2 John and one's in 3 John. 2 John 1 and verse 12. 2 John 1, 12. Or I guess you could just say 2 John 12. There's only one, there's not really a chapter, it's just a book. 2 John verse 12. He's writing to an elect lady, and he says at the end of the epistle, "Having many things to write unto you, I would not write with paper and ink, but I trust to come unto you and speak face to face, that our joy may be full." So he could have kept writing. It's not a very long epistle. It wouldn't take, but you know, not that many minutes to write this epistle. You look at some of the other epistles that he wrote, they were longer. 1 John was longer. The book of John was way longer. The book of Revelation was way longer. Paul's epistles are way longer. Look at some of the Old Testament prophets. I mean, they're many, many times longer. It wasn't that John ran out of ink or that he couldn't write. He intentionally decided to not write, but wait to speak face to face. And what is the reason for that? At least one of the reasons that he gives there. That our joy may be full. It should be an enjoyable thing to speak face to face with somebody, if you like the person anyway. It's more enjoyable to speak face to face than to get a letter. Now, letters are better than other forms of communication, I think. I think most of us probably enjoy getting a handwritten letter more than an email or a text or some modern thing like that. But there's nothing that matches up with face to face communication. And we have lost this today. We have lost the art and the blessing in a large part of face-to-face communication in our modern day. But I have more to say about that, but let's read 3 John 13 and 14. He's writing here to an elder. And he says there in 13 and 14, "I had many things to write, but I will not with ink and pen write unto thee." It's not because he couldn't afford an extra stamp. He had a reason for it. "But I trust I shall shortly see thee, and we shall speak face to face. Peace be to thee. Our friends salute thee. Greet the friends by name." So again, he chose to cut the letter off short to speak face to face. Now, I guess I wish he wouldn't have. I wish he would have kept writing, because I don't know what he said to, what was the guy's name? Gaius. I don't know what he said to Gaius. I don't know what he said to the elect lady. I wish I did. I wish he would have kept writing. But for their sake, it was better. It was better for him to come face to face. John extolled, the Bible extols, face to face communication, not Facebook communication, not FaceTime communication, face to face communication. And we ought to as well. Texting, emailing, social media, and even talking on the phone are no substitute for face-to-face communication. They're just not. They're better than nothing, but they're no substitute. And we've really lost, like I said, I think people are losing the art of communicating directly with each other, face-to-face, of actually having conversations, even talking on the phone. Kids today can't talk on the phone, let alone communicate face-to-face. And when I say they can't talk on the phone, and when I say kids, I'm talking teens and 20-somethings, okay? Teens and 20-somethings, or younger than that, but teens and 20-somethings in particular, they can't talk on the phone. And I'm not really hyperbolizing very much when I say they can't. They hardly have the ability to do so in an effective, comfortable manner. My brother hired two different young, I don't know, young 20s or late teen, 19, 20, something like that, hired two different young people to work for him, to answer the phone, basically. They had to fire him. They couldn't talk on the phone. They did not have the ability to hold a conversation over the phone to talk to a customer. They were no good at it. They didn't want to do it. They hated it. And because they've never had experience doing that. Because if you're in your teens or 20s, you don't even know what a phone is for. If you ask somebody in their teens and 20s, what do you use a phone for? Everything but talking would be the answer. It'd be texting, it'd be social media, it'd be YouTube, it'd be TikTok, it'd be dating apps, it'd be whatever the heck they use these things for. Talking would be like last on the list if they even thought about it. These kids do not talk on the phone. When I grew up, and when all of you grew up, well, maybe with the exception of my wife, I don't know, but when all of you grew up and I grew up, we talked with our friends on the phone. Were there phones when you guys grew up? Yeah, okay. So, anyway, yeah, on the wall, right. Right, and mine, ours were, yeah, we had them too, a big long cord, like a 25-foot cord, so you could take it into another room or whatever. We talked on the phone, or we went out. This is another novel thing that we used to do back in the day that kids don't do today. We actually went out. We left the house, or we went places. We went, like, to the mall. I don't even know, anybody know what a mall is these days? But we went to a mall, or went downtown, or just did something, right? We actually got together and spent time together, face-to-face. That was my generation, growing up in the 80s and 90s. Kids don't do that anymore, for in large part. They don't talk on the phone. They don't even know how. So parents, I would exhort you to make your children talk on the phone. Teach them how to talk on the phone. That is a valuable skill. Because if you don't, your kids are going to, if they're not comfortable talking on the phone or in person, their social and professional lives are going to be greatly hindered. Greatly hindered. If you cannot talk on the phone, the amount of jobs that you're going to be able to have are going to be greatly diminished. If you can't talk face to face with somebody, the amount of jobs that you're going to have and the success you're going to have in the world is going to be greatly diminished if you can't even have a conversation with somebody. These kids can't even go to it. They take their parents with them to a job interview. You ever heard about this? These Gen Z kids take their parents with them to a job interview? I've heard about this. Pitiful. Pitiful. My mom made me talk on the phone to adults. At least in one, I remember one time in particular, probably happened more than once. But I wanted to play with the neighbor kids who were my distant cousins. I said, "Mom, will you call up Marita and ask him if Lars and Jens can go and if I can come down and play or if they can come up here and play?" And she said, "You call her." I don't want to. I was little. I don't know how little I was, 10, 12, something like that. Maybe, yeah, probably 10. "I don't want to." "No, you call. You call, you ask her." And I was scared and embarrassed and it was uncomfortable because, God forbid, I had to dial the number of a neighbor that I knew quite well and talk on the phone. But that's how you learn to do it, right? My mom made me call. And look where I am now. I mean, imagine where I'd be if my mom wouldn't have done that. I'd be some social delinquent now, wouldn't even know how to do anything. So, now, another term for communication, and one that's similar to it and shares the same cognate, is to commune. And the Bible talks about this as well. We already read a verse about that, as a matter of fact. To commune is to talk together, converse, to confer, consult, with a view to decision. It's to hold intimate, chiefly mental or spiritual intercourse with. So to commune carries a little bit more weight, I think, than to communicate, because commune carries with it that connotation of intimate communication, where two people are having some serious, you know, some real meeting of the minds communication. And the Bible talks about people communing together. When you commune with someone, you reveal to them what's in your mind. I'm not going to read this passage, but it's in Genesis 23, 8 through 11. And it said there that Abraham communed with the sons of Heth. His wife had just died, and he needed a place to bury her. And it says that they communed together, and he essentially asked for a burying plot. And they said, well, here, you can have this one. And he said, well, I want to buy it off of you. I don't want you to just give it to me. I want to pay for it. And right. So anyway, they shared what was in their minds, and they came to an agreement. And he got a place to bury his wife, just as an example of communing. One more that I will turn you to is the Queen of Sheba. She communed with Solomon of all that was in her heart. 1 Kings 10 and verse 2. 1 Kings 10. In verse 2. 2 Kings, just a minute here. 1 Kings 10, 2. And she, that is the Queen of Sheba, and she came to Jerusalem with a great train, with camels that bear spices, and very much gold and precious stones. And when she was come to Solomon, she communed with him of all that was in her heart. Here's a queen, very rich lady, and she comes with all this wealth, all these gifts to give to Solomon. And what does she want to do? She wants to commune. Like, you can tell where her priorities are. She's heard Solomon's a wise man, and she wants to talk to him, get her questions answered, right? Pick his mind. She was more concerned about that than probably looking at all of his vast wealth and all of his palaces and the temple and all this great thing. What did she want to do more than anything else? Commune of all that was in her heart. Ask him all the hard questions. And she was just blown away. But in order to commune intimately with others, we must first commune with ourselves so that we know ourselves and have a thought-out philosophy of life on which to base our thoughts and conversation. Let me just give you a few verses here that exhort us to know ourselves, to commune with ourselves, have conversation with ourselves. That's really where, if you want to be a good conversationalist, you have to start having a conversation with yourself. You have to commune with yourself. You have to know and understand yourself. And then you have to, I believe anyway, I think it's important to learn, spend time learning, reading, gaining knowledge, and then putting all that together and getting yourself a thought-out personal philosophy of life so that you understand what it is you believe and that you can then base your thoughts and communication and interaction with others based on your core set of principles and philosophy that you have well thought out. I think it's very important. Let me just give you some verses here about communing with yourself. Psalm 4 and verse 4. Stand in awe and sin not. Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. Selah. Commune. So have that intimate communication. And it's neat, as human beings, we can do that. We can have communication with ourself. Like, our soul and spirit can talk to ourself. You can have a whole conversation in your own head where you can convince yourself of something, refute something that you believe that's erroneous, where you can talk yourself into doing something or talk yourself out of doing something. You can have this whole conversation going on inside your own head. It's really interesting. You can commune with yourself, and you should. Psalm 77 and verse 6. Psalm 77 and verse 6. Because if you haven't done this and you haven't really gotten to know yourself very well, and if you don't really have a broad knowledge and a working philosophy of life, then, you know, when you have conversations that spring up about interesting things, your response is going to be, I don't know, never thought about that. And that doesn't make for a very good conversation. When somebody brings up some interesting topic and all you can say is, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. Like, but if you've already thought about it, maybe, you know, and you're like, oh, well, you know, I've read something about that and, you know, I've thought, maybe, you know, along these lines on that topic or whatever. So I think it really helps to be a good conversationalist if you have that personal philosophy already nailed down. And then that philosophy can change over time as you talk to other people, and iron sharpens iron, and you can learn more. Because the more you know, the more easy it is to learn. The more things you know, the easier it is to learn. You can plug all the new information into all the things you currently know and add that into your knowledge and tweak things. Anyway, Psalm 77 and verse 6. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. So he's communing, having a conversation with himself. And then the wisest man that ever lived, Solomon, he communed with himself. And this makes sense, because if you're the wisest man that ever lived, who else are you going to commune with? Your only choice are a bunch of dummies, so you just got to sit there and talk to yourself because everybody else is stupid, right? And that's not even necessary. I mean, I'm being funny, but that's not really even true either. Because no matter how smart you are, you can learn from anybody. Even if somebody's, you know, not all that intelligent, he certainly knows something you don't know. I mean, everybody knows something that you don't know. So you can learn all kinds of stuff from all kinds of people. So that's why it's important to communicate with people, to talk with people, because, you know, you really expand your horizons and you expand your experiences. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 16, Solomon said, I commune with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. Now, let me just keep reading for the fun of it. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. So I just got done telling you that it's good to talk with people to increase your knowledge, but it'll increase your sorrow as well. The more you know, the more sorrow you're going to have in your life, typically. Which is paradoxical in a way, but it is true. But did you ever notice how it's so enjoyable to converse with somebody who knows a lot about a lot, but who is not arrogant and full of himself and a know-it-all? Like, and usually, sometimes those two things are, it's hard to find a person that has both. It's hard to find a person that knows a lot about a lot and that's not arrogant and a know-it-all, right? And just wants to sit there and blather on about everything he knows. But have you ever met somebody like that that's just very knowledgeable about all kinds of stuff? And, you know, anything you bring up, he knows a little bit about it anyway. You can just have a really interesting conversation. That's great. And that's why I think it's important to commune with yourself, know yourself, read a broad array of things, and then take some time and put all those things that you read and you've thought about and arrange them all in your mind into a well-thought-out philosophy. And then you have a good basis for having good quality conversation. Now, I would say that this can be a negative as well. This can be a negative if your personal philosophy is very different from most other people's philosophy. And I found this out the hard way. Now, this is not to say that my personal philosophy is right and everybody else's is wrong. Of course, I think that's the case. Who doesn't? Right? Do any of you think your personal philosophy is wrong and everybody else's is right? Does anybody believe that? I mean, who believes that? My personal philosophy is completely 100% off base. I am wrong on every single thing I think. And that all these other people are all right. I mean, nobody thinks that. Everybody thinks their philosophy is right, right? That doesn't mean it is. But I've found that this can be a negative if your personal philosophy is very different from other people. This can really put a damper on being a conversationalist and having good quality conversations. Because honestly, I've found that I have to keep a lot of my opinions and principles to myself around most people. I'm serious. I feel like I have to self-censor and keep my mouth shut and keep my opinions to myself and my principles to myself around most people. And that goes for most things that I have opinions on too, which is kind of weird. And I was just thinking about this morning, and I just started jotting down, and I'm not going to go into detail on any of these things, but just all the things that through my years of life that I've come to have an opinion on that are different than what most people have opinions on. And these are things that pretty much cover every aspect of life. And this is why I say that a lot of times in conversations, I just have to keep my mouth shut or end up getting, you know, somebody's uncomfortable, somebody's offended, so, you know, think I'm crazy or extreme or strange or something like that. But marital roles, family ideals, child training, education, financial matters, medical, economics, government, politics, entertainment, TV, music, sports, religion, war, Zionism, college, food, debt, self-reliance, Medicare, Social Security, government programs and grants, smartphones, social media, health insurance, and toilet paper. Just to name a few. Now you think, how in the world can your personal philosophy on toilet paper be that different from the rest of the population? I will share just this one with you. I believe that people that use it are uncultured barbarians. So there you go. That just drives a wedge between me and 99% of Americans right there. I'm kidding, sort of. But, you know, when I share my opinions about any of those matters or many others, people probably think I'm crazy, extreme, strange, or it just makes them uncomfortable. And this can even be the case with people that are in the faith. I mean, honestly, you know my opinions on plenty of things, but if I sat down and shared my opinion on all those things and some others, I'd probably make a lot of you uncomfortable. I might even make some of you mad if I really told you what I think. Because I kind of, you know, I scale it back. I scale my opinions back, typically, as we all do, you know, and kind of sugarcoat them. But if I really told you what I think about a lot of those things, it'd probably make a lot of people uncomfortable. Even people in the faith might even make you mad at me. So this is why I say I guess there could be a danger if you have your own personal well-thought-out philosophy, and if it happens to be different than most of the people in this world hold, it does make conversation a little bit difficult because, you know, you just, what is there to talk about, really, except the weather and whatever else, you know, non-controversial things. And you could even get controversial about the weather, too, I guess. If you, I mean, you know, I just heard about the, you know, there's ideas that the hurricanes are being directed to go certain places. So you could even get, you could even get into fights about the weather, I suppose. But anyway. Communication skills are necessary to impart thoughts and information to others effectively. And probably the most important piece of information that you can communicate to somebody else is the gospel of Jesus Christ. And you need communication skills to be able to do that. The gospel is transmitted from one person to another by verbal or written communication. Galatians 2 and verse 2. Galatians 2:2. And I went up by revelation and communicated unto them that gospel which I preach among the Gentiles, but privately to them which were of reputation, lest by any means I should run or had run in vain. So he is talking about when he went to Jerusalem to that council. You remember in Acts chapter 15, there were these Jews that had infiltrated some of the Gentile churches and taught them that they had to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses to be saved. And so this became a problem and a controversy. And so they sent Paul and Barnabas and some others to the church in Jerusalem to have a council to determine this once and for all. Do the Gentiles need to be circumcised or not? And this is what Paul is talking about here. When he went to Jerusalem, went up by revelation, and he communicated unto them that gospel he preaches among the Gentiles. But notice he says he did it privately to them that were of reputation, because he didn't want to have wasted and undone the work that he had previously done. Because there were some Jews there that were believers that were of reputation, and if he would have just publicly talked about how the law of Moses is abolished and circumcision is unnecessary and so on, some of the other believing Jews that were zealous of the law might have been offended by this, and that might have put a wedge between these people that he's trying to explain this to and these other people. So the ones that were of reputation, he communicated it privately. And we can learn from that that to effectively communicate the gospel or anything else to others, it's not only necessary to transmit the facts to the other person, but also to do so at an opportune time and in a manner that will increase its likelihood of being received. So Paul, in another place, I think it's in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he said that he was all things to all men. To the Jews he became as a Jew, to them without the law as without the law, right? So he became all things to all men. So in order to effectively communicate, sometimes you have to look for the opportune time, you have to say it at the right time, in the right place, and there might be times where you just keep your mouth shut for a while and wait. For instance, I was just thinking about an example of this. Say you have a friend, maybe a friend at work or something, and this friend is Catholic, and you've been sharing the gospel with him, and you haven't told him about how Christmas is a pagan holiday yet, because Christmas is a big deal among Catholics. The time to do that would not be when he invites you to come to the Catholic family reunion in front of everybody and say, hey, you know, did you know Christmas is a pagan holiday, in the presence of all of his family, and they all hear this, right? That would not be the time to do it, right? This is exactly what Paul did. You wait until you can do it privately, and you explain to him then. And then maybe he'll be able to see it, and then eventually he can slowly explain that to his parents, and they can get mad later after he's already been convinced of it. But if you did it right in front of them, and they get mad, and they all pounce on you like a pack of hyenas, chances are you're not going to get the message through to him at that time. And then also, to communicate our faith to others effectively, we must be humble and acknowledge that every good thing in us is in Jesus Christ. This is in Philippians 1 and verse 6. Nobody likes a proud know-it-all, especially when it comes to religion. So if we're going to communicate our faith, we have to do so humbly. We have to acknowledge that any good thing that's in us is only there because of Jesus Christ. Philippians 1 and verse 6. Now, if I could find... Philemon is the book that I want. I can't even find that one, but if I could find it. Philemon 1 and verse 6. That the communication of thy faith may become effectual by the acknowledging of every good thing which is in you in Christ Jesus. So in order for the communication of your faith to be effectual, that is, to have its intended effect, to actually accomplish what you want it to accomplish, you must acknowledge that every good thing which is in you is in Christ Jesus. That there, as Paul said, there lieth in me, that is in my flesh, no good thing. Any good thing in me is only in Christ Jesus. Because if it weren't for Christ Jesus, none of us would have any good in us. We would all be a bunch of just rotten sinners by nature. All right, now I mentioned when Abraham communed with God back there in Genesis 18. And let's turn back there. And we're going to see that communication skills are necessary to negotiate, especially from a position of weakness. Genesis 18, we're going to look at, we'll start off with verses 20 through 22, and then I'll just step through the other verses instead of reading the whole passage at the same time. Genesis 18. Genesis 18, 20 through 22. And the Lord said, because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which is come unto me, and if not, I will know. And the men turned their faces from thence and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. So the Lord's about ready to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. He's going to go check it out. He's going to inquire and find out, which is interesting because God knows everything. But God also sometimes enters into time, and he interacts with us like a human being, essentially. And he, like when Abraham offered Isaac, and the Lord said, now I know that Abraham believed in him, or had, I forget exactly how he said it, but I just remember he said, now I know. Well, God always knew. But he enters into time sometimes, and he deals with us like a human being would. So he's ready to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And for whatever reason, Abraham has compassion on these Sodomites. I mean, this was a terribly wicked place. But Abraham just, I guess, felt bad that maybe there were some righteous people in there and didn't want to see the righteous destroyed along with the wicked. So Abraham starts to reason with God. And let's just notice some of the communication skills that Abraham employs here when negotiating with God. He first reasons from the concept of justice in verse 23. And Abraham drew near and said, wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Right? Just asking a question. I mean, he's kind of appealing to God's sense of justice here. Would it be right to destroy the righteous along with the wicked? Because if you destroy the whole city, you're gonna destroy the bad with the good. So he reasons from a concept of justice. And then he's got the underhand because he's arguing with God. Right? Anytime you're arguing with God, you got the underhand, right? You are not in a position of strength when you're arguing with God. So having the underhand, he begins his negotiation with a reasonable offer that's not likely to be rejected. Now, remember this when you are negotiating with any person and you have the underhand, right? When you are coming at it from a position of weakness, you don't try to get everything you want right off the bat, right? You come up with a reasonable offer first. Abraham says, peradventure, there be 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are therein? Notice he doesn't start off and say, Lord, if there's one righteous person, will you spare this whole city? He starts off with 50, right? Which is, that's a reasonable offer. Well, 50 people, that's quite a few, I guess. I mean, I guess if there's 50, right, then well, maybe I wouldn't destroy a whole city if there's 50 decent people in it. So he starts off with a reasonable offer. That was wise on Abraham's part. Of course, God's just allowing him to win the negotiation. You know that, right? I mean, Abraham's not like somehow figured out how to outsmart God. And God's like, well, I was going to destroy it, but now you've talked me out of it. God's just kind of playing along. You know, like you do with a little kid and you let him win the game, right? God's just playing along with Abraham. But you see here good negotiation skills anyway. Then he appeals to God's righteousness, verse 25. That be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee. Shall not the judge of the earth do right? So now he's appealing to God's righteousness. I mean, you're the judge of the earth, Lord. Aren't you going to do right? Would it be right to destroy the wicked with the righteous? So he's appealing to God's righteousness. And then having made it through round one, he proceeds with humility, and he keeps trying a little more, verses 26 through 28. And the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. And Abraham answered and said, behold, now I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes. See, he proceeds with humility here. He recognizes and tells the Lord, I'm just dust and ashes. I'm nothing. Peradventure there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Wilt thou destroy all the city that lack of 5? And he said, if I find 40 and 5, I will not destroy it. So it's interesting. He again starts off slow. He starts off with another reasonable offer. He goes from 50 to 45. He didn't jump the whole way down to 25, right? He just went down a little bit to 45. He's making some headway here. And he said, verse 29, and he said unto him, yet again, and he spake unto him yet again, and said, peradventure, there shall be 40 found there. So he tries another 5 increment. And he said, I will not do it for 40's sake. And he said unto him, oh, let not the Lord be angry. See, he's showing his humility. He knows he's treading on thin ice at this point. And I will speak, peradventure, there shall be 30 found there. Now he goes for a whole 10 more. He's gone for 5 twice. And now he's getting a little bit more bold, and that's probably why he says, let not the Lord be angry. He knows he's going to ask for a little bit more, and it might be too much, but he's still proceeding with humility. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. So he just keeps building off these previous successes, and he incrementally keeps asking for more while continuing to humble himself. Verse 31, and he said, behold, now I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord. Peradventure, there should be 20 found there. So now he's going down. He's going down by the same amount. He's gone from 40 to 30 to 20. But you know, by percentage, he's actually increasing. From 40 to 30 is only 10%, right? 10%, 25%. 25%. From 30 to 20 is 33 1/3%, right? So he's actually increasing the percentage, but you know, just going down the same number value. Pretty clever on Abraham's part, I would say. And he said, I will not destroy it for 20's sake. Then notice the last part of the negotiation is Abraham knows when to quit. He knows when He's done probably as good as he's going to do. And if he goes any further than this, it's probably going to be diminishing returns, actually negative returns. The Lord might just get mad and say, you know what? I'm done. I'm just going to destroy him. I don't want to hear it. So he knows when to quit. Verse 32, and he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once. And notice he kept his promise. He said, he didn't say that before. He didn't say before, I'll speak but yet but once. But this time he says, I'll speak yet but once. And he means it. So when you say something in a negotiation, you don't say, well, let me just give you one more counteroffer. Don't try another one after that, right? You say one more, that's one more. Peradventure 10 should be found there. Now he's jumping by another 50%, right? Still the same number 10, but now from 20 to 10, that's 50%, right? He's taking a big cut. He's going out on a limb. And he said, I will not destroy it for 10's sake. And the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place. So Abraham knew when to quit. Now, as it turned out, there weren't even 10 righteous, and the Lord destroyed the city anyway. But if there would have been even 10 righteous, the Lord would not have destroyed that city. Abraham would have saved an entire city by his negotiation skills had there just been 10 righteous. And we know there was at least one righteous, Lot, right? So there weren't 9 others. There weren't 9 other righteous people in that city, which is pretty pitiful considering it was, you know, probably thousands of people, I would guess, or at least hundreds. Now, I want to spend the rest of the sermon talking about tips on communication. And this is the section that I was telling you that I had put together all these thoughts that I had just kind of stuck in the back of my mind for years and just made little notes and thought that these things were really interesting in the Bible, but never really had a place to preach on them. Although I've covered some of them in the past, but I haven't covered other ones, I don't think. So, number one tip on communication: not all questions need answered. Sometimes we fall into that trap. We think that we have to answer every question. If somebody asks us a question, we owe them an answer just because they asked the question. You don't have to answer every question. Jesus Christ gave us plenty of examples of this. With the Samaritan woman, when he was conversing with her, he repeatedly ignored her distracting questions and directed the conversation where he wanted to take it. Now, I actually preached on this chapter, on this passage, several years ago. It was down here. It was in Excelsior Springs. I remember that. I don't remember exactly when it was, and I think it was something about contending for the faith like Jesus did, or something like that. I don't remember the title. I didn't look before I came this morning. But anyway, I gave a lot more detail. You can listen to that sermon if you want to get a lot more information on this. But anyway, in John 4:7 through 16, let's just see how Jesus just keeps ignoring our questions. And a lot of us would probably, almost feel rude. Like we're having a conversation and somebody asks a question, and we just pay no attention to it and just continue on, taking it where we want it to go. But there's nothing wrong with that, especially if you are doing this for the purpose of converting somebody. Because when you're trying to convert somebody, they're going to have a million questions about a million things and diverting off this way and that way. And you're going to end up, and I've been there, believe me, you're going to end up all over the place. You're going to be chasing rabbits, answering questions, and you're going to get nowhere. If you really want to get somewhere, you got to stick to the point at hand, and you got to call in those roving thoughts, and you have to force the other person to pay attention and to deal with the subject at hand and not go off on these tangents. John 4:7 through 16. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink. For his disciples were gone away unto the city to buy meat. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Now that would have totally derailed the conversation. If they'd have got into a fight about Jews and Samaritans and who's right and who's wrong and all the history of that, Jesus would have never got to where he wanted this conversation to go. So he just totally ignores it. Now, you know that would be hard to do. It'd be hard to not say, yeah, well, let me tell you about the Samaritans. You know where you Samaritans came from? Right? That was Jeroboam when you created these these false gods up there in northern Israel, and then eventually you got taken over by the Assyrians, and the Assyrians brought a bunch of pagans in and took a bunch of the Jews out, and then the pagans started worshiping, fearing the Lord and worshiping the idols, and that's where you filthy Samaritans come from. Where would that conversation have gone? All right, nowhere. He just totally ignores it. Verse 10, Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou would have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. The woman saith unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with. She's not all that bright. She doesn't quite understand. And the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, which gave us the well, and drank thereof himself, and his children, and his cattle? Now, if Jesus said, as a matter of fact, I am greater than Jacob, I am the Messiah, I am the promised seed of Jacob, yes, I am greater than him, yes, I not only could I have drilled this well, I created the very earth that this well is on, I created the water down there in the ground, yes, I'm greater than Jacob. It's not the point, right? That would have totally derailed the conversation, wouldn't it have? He just ignores the question. Verse 16, Jesus answered and said unto her, whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. The woman saith unto him, sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. And Jesus saith unto her, go call thy husband and come hither. See, she still doesn't get it. She's like, I would love to have this water you're talking about. If I didn't have to come back to this well and draw out this water, if you give me this water that just would quench my thirst forever, physically, that would be awesome. And Jesus says, go call thy husband. He's taking this conversation in the direction he wants it to go, and he's ignoring all of her questions. It's a good tactic to use when witnessing to others about biblical things. Don't let them derail the conversation with irrelevant questions. Just ignore them and say that we can get back, or say that we can get back to them later. So either just totally ignore them and just continue talking what you're talking about, or just say, you know what, we can discuss that later. If you're talking about sovereign grace and they say, hey, I heard you don't celebrate Christmas, we can talk about that later. Let's get back to total depravity, right? Otherwise, you're just going to be chasing questions all over the place and getting nowhere. Let me give you another example of Jesus not answering questions. Jesus was with a bunch of freeloaders one time. He just gave them a free lunch. And some of these unbelieving Jews then tracked him down on the other side of the sea, and they asked him when he got there. And look at what he says. John 6 and verse 25. John 6, 25. And when they had found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, Rabbi, when camest thou hither? When did you come here? He didn't say, well, at about 6:30 in the evening. He didn't say that at all. He just totally ignored the question. He ignores the question, and then he tells them that they weren't seeking him because of the miracles, but because of the free food. Verse 26, Jesus answered them and said, verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me, not because ye saw the miracles, but because ye did eat the loaves and were filled. Didn't bother to answer the question when he got there. He's like, you know what? You're seeking me because of the free food. You don't care. You didn't even care about the miracles. The miracles didn't even matter to you. You didn't even pay attention to that. You just like the free food. So don't waste your time answering questions from people who are not seeking Jesus for the right reason. You find somebody that's supposedly seeking Jesus, but you can tell that it's not for the right reason. Don't waste your time answering the questions. And here's another note, something to consider. If churches give out free meals to the public, they should expect to get freeloading, quote, followers of Jesus. You'll get more of what you subsidize. You give away free food, you're going to get the crowd that likes free food. Now, that's a way to build a crowd. I went to this, I think it was a SAFE meeting. It was about an organization here in town about keeping kids off of drugs or something like that. I don't remember. And they had a speaker come in, and I think it was actually the Clay County prosecutor came in and was talking about some subject anyway. There were like 50 people at this thing. It was in the middle of the day. It was at lunchtime on a weekday. I mean, it was up in the hospital. The room was packed. You know why it was packed? It wasn't because the Clay County prosecutor was there. You know why it was packed? Because they gave a free lunch. That's why it was packed. If you didn't give a free lunch, I bet you there'd have been three people in there, and one of them would have been the prosecutor, and the other one would have been his assistant, and then the other one would have been the lady that was putting on the event. You want to build a crowd, give away free food. But guess what kind of a church you're going to have when you give away free stuff? You're going to have that kind of people that are just looking for free stuff. Then you have another example with Jesus, witnessing to unbelieving Jews. When he received a question from those who did not believe on him, he just ignored it, and he instead told them what to do. John 12, 34 through 40. And by the way, you know who one of the people that would not have been at that meeting was if there wasn't a free lunch? Me. I'm like, oh, what the heck, it's a free lunch. I might learn something. You think I would have gone if I wouldn't have had a free lunch? Absolutely not. If it was something that I truly was interested in, yes. But if it was something like, eh, you know, well, whatever, I don't know. John 12, 34 through 40. The people answered him, "We have heard out of the law that Christ abideth forever. And how sayest thou, the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?" You see, they're asking him a question like, who's this Son of Man? Who's this Messiah you're talking about? I mean, we've heard that Christ abides forever, and you're saying he's going to be lifted up, so he's going to die. How? I mean, if he lives forever, how's he going to die? Like, in one way, you can think, oh, they're asking a good question, right? But Jesus could perceive that they were unbelievers, that this was not a question they were genuinely trying to find an answer, but this was a skeptical question. And look at the rest, look at his answer. Jesus said unto them, "Yet a little while is the light with you. Walk while ye have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walketh in darkness knoweth not whither he goeth. While ye have light, believe in the light, that ye may be the children of light." Notice he did not answer their question at all. He just told them what to do. "These things spake Jesus and departed and did hide himself from them. But though he had done so many miracles before them, yet they believed not on him, that the saying of Esaias the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spake, Lord, who hath believed our report, and to whom hath the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe, because that Esaias said again, he hath blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, that they should not see with their eyes, nor understand with their heart, and be converted, and I should heal them." So Jesus knew the nature of these people. Jesus knows the heart of all men. He knew that they weren't believers. He knew that they weren't asking a legitimate question, and therefore he just ignored it. He didn't even bother answering it and just told them what they should do. And then you have another example back in the Old Testament of Nehemiah. He was rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem, and some of his enemies tried to get him to come down and meet with them. And Nehemiah wasn't having any of it. He wasn't going to waste his time with these people. Nehemiah 6, 1 through 2. I love this passage. It's a good one to remember. Nehemiah 6, 1 through 2. "Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono." And I always like to say to myself, and Nehemiah said, "Oh no." "But they thought to do me mischief." See, he was perceptive. They say, "Oh, hey, come on down. Let's go to one of the villages and let's have a talk. You know, we just want to have a meeting of the minds here and see what you're up to and maybe we can help out." But he says, "No, they thought to do me mischief." He wasn't going to waste his time with them. They want to have a conversation. He's like, "No, I'm not doing that." He perceived that they had thought to do him mischief and declined their request, saying that he had a great work to do and he would not stop and waste his time with them. Verse 3. "And he sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you?" I remember when we were out in Montana, we visited Chuck Baldwin's church, and he was preaching on this verse, and it just really really resonated with me when he said that, I am doing a great work, I cannot come down. Why should the work cease that I go come down to you? And that's a good verse for every gospel preacher to remember, because there are a lot of people out there that want to waste your time. There's a lot of people out there that want to ask you a million questions that are just going to waste your time. They're ever learning, never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. They're not sincerely asking. They just want to argue or they want to fight. I am doing a great work. I cannot come down. I'm not going to waste my time with your stupid questions. That's a good thing for preachers to remember. And it's a good thing for all people to remember. If you're doing a great work, if you're doing something worthwhile, don't waste your time answering questions from people that are either envious of you or that are trying to stop you from doing what you're doing for whatever reason. Don't waste your time. Never take time away from what you should be doing to talk with people who are going to waste your time. And to a lesser extent, this happens in offices every day, all the time. You're standing at the water cooler and some clown comes up and starts talking to you and wastes half an hour of your workday talking about some dumb thing. You know how much productivity is wasted by somebody showing up at your desk and shooting the breeze for a half an hour? Happens all the time. I am doing a great work. Get out of my cubicle. I don't have time for this. I'm not being paid to talk with you about whatever nonsense you want to talk about. Now, these guys were persistent. They repeated their request four times, to all of which Nehemiah gave the same response. I love this. Verse 4, yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. And that is such a good lesson to learn. Four times they kept nagging him, and he didn't bother coming up with new ways to decline their repeated requests. He just kept repeating the same answer, and that's what you do. When fools keep trying to get you to change your mind on something or keep asking you the same thing, requesting that you do something for them, don't try to come up with seven ways from Sunday to explain to them why you're not going to do it. Just say no and give them the same reason you gave them before. Because as soon as you give them a different reason, then they're going to come at it from another angle and then another angle and another angle. Just say no. Same thing with parents. When your kids nag you, you shouldn't let them nag you four times. You shouldn't even let them nag you twice. You tell them no the first time, well, don't answer. Don't ask again. If you ask again, well, you can take care of that by nonverbal means, if you know what I mean. And if you find out he went and asked mom about it after he asked you about it and you said no, give him a spanking. And then, here's another one. Ignore stupid questions. This is hard to do sometimes. We fall into this. You know, somebody asks a stupid question, and you feel the need to respond to it. You feel the need to answer it. But, you know, the Bible is replete with commandments here to not give heed to stupid questions. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 23. I know this is a hard one for me because I almost feel guilty if I don't answer any question that's asked to me. But there are some questions that just don't deserve answers. I'll give you a couple of examples here in a minute. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 23. But foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strifes. You know, he didn't say entertain them, he said avoid them. 1 Timothy 1 and verse 4. 1 Timothy 1, 4. Neither give heed to fables and endless genealogies which minister questions rather than godly edifying, which is in faith, so do. So don't give heed to fables and endless genealogies. This was probably more of a thing then than it was today, with the Jews especially. Endless genealogies, you know, going back through the genealogies in the Old Testament and coming up with all these questions. Titus 3 and verse 9. Titus 3 and verse 9, but avoid foolish questions and genealogies and contentions and strivings about the law, for they are unprofitable and vain. So you don't have to answer unlearned, foolish questions, questions about genealogies or strivings about the law. So if I get questions that would require an excessive amount of time to answer about obscure Old Testament laws, because there are some places back in the Old Testament law of Moses that, you know, I mean, you don't, they're difficult to make sense of in some cases. But the law of Moses is abolished. And if it's part of the law that's abolished and we're not under that law anyway, I'm not going to waste a ton of time trying to dig into and understand and explain some difficult law back there when we're not under it anyway. And there's more important things that I could be using my time with. Or discrepancies in genealogies. You read back through the genealogies and you'll find plenty of discrepancies. You'll find people that are left out. You look at Matthew's genealogy and Luke, I don't know about Luke's. Matthew's genealogy leaves out several names. And there, I mean, it's interesting to look into that and why that could be. But you could get into all kinds of debates about these genealogies. And Paul says, don't do it. You got the genealogy of Christ right there. That's all you need. You don't need to get involved in all these arguments about it. Don't strive over words to no profit, but only engage in conversations with the intent of subverting the hearers. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 14. This should be our goal. This is a good type of subversion. To overthrow the false ideas in somebody else's head, to bring into captive every thought to the obedience of Christ, casting down vain imaginations. This is a good type of subversion. This should be our focus when we are sharing the faith with other people. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 14. Of these things put them in remembrance, charging them before the Lord that they strive not about words to no profit, but to the subverting of the hearers. See, if you answer every question and you get diverted off on these arguments, and then you start striving over these words and striving over genealogies and striving over obscure Old Testament laws or something, where are you getting? I mean, that you should be trying to subvert them to change their mind about the gospel of Jesus Christ. We're told to shun profane and vain babblings. They're in verse 16, 2 Timothy 2, 16. But shun profane and vain babblings, for they will increase unto more ungodliness. Profane, that is secular, non-religious. Profane and vain babblings. Vain or worthless, useless babblings. So when people come up and they want to talk to you about who knows what, some secular topic, some political topic, maybe some conspiratorial topic that's way out there and just some nutso thing, don't waste your time with it. Don't waste your time with it. And then he tells Titus, don't give heed to Jewish fables. You notice all these passages are in the pastoral epistles. Like this is important for a pastor to be able to limit the types of questions that he takes and not waste his time. It's very clear from just the multitude of passages here. Titus 1 and verse 14. Not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men that turn from the truth. Jewish fables, like the fable that Jesus Christ's disciples stole his body away, right? That's a Jewish fable. A more modern Jewish fable is dispensationalism. This idea that Jesus is coming back and rapturing out the church and then 7 years later setting up this physical kingdom in national Israel, and he's going to reign from Jerusalem and restore the Jewish nation and all this stuff. Jewish fables, don't take heed to them. And then lastly, Paul tells Timothy to refuse profane and old wives' fables. 1 Timothy 4:7. But refuse profane and old wives' fables, and exercise thyself rather unto godliness. So these verses, as I said, are written to pastors and make it clear that they do not need to entertain and answer all questions they receive, especially stupid ones. Like, for instance, if somebody comes to me and says, hey, pastor, can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? You know what I'm going to say? Foolish and unlearned questions avoid. I'm not answering your dumb questions. Did Adam have a belly button? You know, there's all kinds of foolish and unlearned, stupid questions out there. How many millions of angels could dance on the head of a pin? You know, this was actually one of the questions that the old scholastic philosophers, the Catholic philosophers, debated about, I've been told. They literally debated about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. No thanks. All right, now the next tip. This one's interesting. At first glance, you might think that this would be wrong. But it's not wrong to play dumb and ask questions you already know the answer to. You know that? You might think, well, that's being deceptive. That's being deceitful. You're almost lying, right? You're pretending like you don't know something that you actually know. And you ask a question you already know the answer to. And so you're being deceitful, right? Not so. Our Lord Jesus Christ did this on several occasions. First of all, on the road to Emmaus, after his resurrection, Jesus walked with two men to Emmaus, during which he asked if he acted as if he did not know what they were talking about, when in fact they were talking about him. Let's look at that. Luke 24, 13 through 19. It's not wrong to play dumb. And behold, two of them went that same day to a village called Emmaus, which was from Jerusalem about 80 furlongs, and they talked together of all things which had happened. This is right after Jesus' resurrection. So they're talking about what happened to Jesus, or not after his resurrection. Well, they didn't know about his resurrection. It was right after he had died anyway. And they talked together of all things which had happened, and it came to pass that while they communed together in reason, Jesus himself drew near and went with them, but their eyes were holden that they should not know him. And he said unto them, what manner of communications are these that ye have one to another as ye walk and are sad? He acts like he doesn't know what they're talking about. They're talking about Jesus had just died and he was crucified and he was buried and what a travesty this is. And he says, hey, what are you talking about? Why are you so sad? He acts like he doesn't even know. And one of them, whose name was Cleophas, or Cleophas maybe, Cleophas probably, or Cleopas, answering said unto him, art thou only a stranger in Jerusalem, and hast not known the things which are come to pass there in these days? And he said unto them, what things? What are you talking about? He's playing dumb. He acts like he has no idea what they're talking about. And they said unto him, concerning Jesus of Nazareth, which was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and have crucified him. He acted like he didn't even know. Like, what are you talking about? What things? He played dumb in order to get them to elaborate so that he could preach the gospel unto them. Verses 25 through 27. Then he said unto them, O fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory? And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So he pretended like he didn't know what they were talking about for a purpose, so that he could then preach the gospel to them and expound the scriptures about himself. He did this to the woman at Samaria also. Remember the Samaritan woman at the well that we looked at? And remember where we left off there, where she says, give me this water so I don't have to come here to draw anymore. And then Jesus asked her this question. Remember that in verse 16, Jesus saith unto her, go call thy husband and come hither. He acts as if he doesn't know. He knew that she was in a relationship with another man that wasn't her husband, but he played dumb and told her to go call her husband. Remember verses 17 and 18. And the woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, thou hast well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had 5 husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that saidst thou truly. So, knowing that she's had 5 husbands, knowing that she's living with a man that she's not married to, he says, go call thy husband. I mean, we could do the same thing today. If you know somehow, you meet maybe some woman and she's got some kids, and you know that she's a fornicator and she's living with some guy, and maybe you want to share with her the gospel or share with her the truth that, you know what, you really should get married. Even though that you know she's not married, you can say, oh, so where's your husband today? Or, when did you guys get married? Right? Even though you know. And then she's like, well, we're not. We just live together. Oh, why are you doing that? Right? You know, you should get married. You know, Jesus says that, God says that you're not supposed to be shacking up with people. You're not married to. You're not, you know, fornication's a sin. Just an example. But again, Jesus played dumb for a purpose, to demonstrate his omniscience to the woman and prove that he was the Messiah. Verse 19, the woman saith unto him, Sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. She's like, wow, how'd you know that? I mean, I've never even met you before. You know I've had five husbands and I'm living with some guy that I'm not married to. You must be a prophet. So she's impressed. And then verses 28 and 29, the woman then left her water pot and went her way into the city and saith to the men, Come, see a man which told me all things that ever I did. Is not this the Christ? You see, this is the point that Jesus wanted to get her to. That's why he ignored all of her dumb questions. That's why he led her down the path that he did. That's why he asked the question, Go get your husband. Right? He did all those things to lead her down this path so that he could show her that he was the Messiah, that he was omnipotent, so that he could demonstrate his power to her. So he did two things that you're never supposed to do, right? He ignored her questions rudely, and he played dumb and acted like he didn't know something that he already did. And then prior to feeding the 5,000, Jesus asked Philip where he should go to buy bread for to feed the multitude that had been following him. John 6 and verse 5. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him. When Jesus then lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, Whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? Now, he knew what he was going to do. He just said this to prove Philip. But he's pretending like, how are we going to feed these people? You know, where are we going to get bread to feed these people? And this he said, verse 6, and this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. And then, of course, Philip plays right into it. Oh, 200 pennyworth couldn't feed this many people. You know, like, how are we going to do that? And then Jesus says, watch this. Make these people sit down. Give me those loaves. I'll show you how we're going to feed them. But again, he played dumb. And this can be an effective tactic when training others, you know, like children or employees, to get them to think for themselves. Asking a question, just like he did here to Philip, you know, how are we going to do this? Maybe you got some employees you're looking at, like, and you say, how are we going to solve this problem? And you already know what to do, but you want to see if you can make them think, and especially if you can make them think that it was their idea. You want to get somebody to do something, make them think it was their idea. And they will gladly do it. If you tell them, hey, here's what we need to do. Do this, this, and this. We're going to solve this problem. They're like, oh, I don't want to do that. If you say, hey, guys, how are we going to solve this problem? This looks like a tough one. Can you think of any ideas? Well, we could do this, this, and this. And you're like, that's a great idea. Why don't you go do that? And I mean, they'll be Johnny on the spot. But if you'd have told them to do that very thing, they would have not wanted to do it. But you make them think it was their idea, they'll be right on it. And then here's one last one for you, the last tip, and this one's really interesting. This is another one where people would say, well, you shouldn't do this. This is kind of manipulation. This is not exactly probably what you should be doing because it's not exactly honest. Well, go tell Jesus about it. It's not wrong to say something to one person when the message is really meant for another person who's hearing it. You ever do that? You ever been standing in a group of people in a conversation and you say something to the person standing right in front of you, and you're really speaking directly to the person beside you? You ever do that? I've done it. I've done it lots of times. Say something to the person in front of me because it's really meant for the person beside me, and I know he's going to hear it or she's going to hear it, and I don't have to say it directly to him or her and make it uncomfortable. You ever do that? I have. And so did Jesus. Jesus spoke to the Father so that the people around him would hear and believe that he was sent by God. John 11, 41 through 42. Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank thee that thou hast heard me, and I knew that thou hearest me always. But because of the people which stand by, I said it, that they may believe that thou hast sent me. See, Jesus said it to the Father, not because it was for the Father, but because it was for the people. He said so they would hear it. You know, maybe you have a friend whose child is sassy and talking back, and you know this is a problem, and you're talking to a few friends, and the friend is standing there, and you say to one friend, I just can't stand it when people let their kids talk back to them. That is so rude, so disrespectful. People, that they ought to spank that kid and not allow them to do that. You're talking to person A, but you're really talking to person B, right? But it's just easier to do that in some situations than to say to person B, hey, you know what? You ought to deal with that child, because maybe person B would get all in a huff about it. But if you say it when that person is in earshot, then you get the point across, right? Across, pardon me, across, not acrossed. Acrossed is a Pennsylvania hillbilly way of saying across, I have come to find out. It's taken me decades to break myself of all the Pennsylvania hillbillyisms. And I still probably have plenty to go. And then the Father one time spoke audibly to Jesus Christ for the sake of the people around him who would hear him. John 12, 28 through 30. Jesus said, Father, glorify thy name. Then came there a voice from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. The people therefore that stood by and heard it said that it thundered. Others said, an angel spake to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice came not because of me, but for your sakes. See, the Father spoke to Jesus, but he really didn't speak it for Jesus. He spake it for the other people's sakes. There's nothing wrong with doing that. So it's therefore okay to say something to one person for the purpose of a bystander hearing it. So I just thought these things were interesting. And like I said, I had collected them over the years, made some notes in my Bible about it, just kind of hid them away in the back of my mind for someday to be able to bring them out. And I thought this was a good opportunity to do so. But next time I'm going to pick it up and finish, Lord willing, the series on communication. And next Sunday is going to be the important stuff, the interesting stuff, the practical stuff. I'm really looking forward to preaching this, and I hope that you'll get something out of it and appreciate it. And I guess this was quite long this morning. I didn't realize that. So I thank you for your patience.